The EMS Garage is a production of EMSRadio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone there wanting to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage, your weekly podcast about all things EMS and everything in between, of course. I'm your host, Chris Montero, and this week, joining me, as always, the most esteemed panel in all of EMS. I have probably some of the best thinkers in EMS tonight. Mr. Will Dunn, for sure. He is awesome. How are you, sir? It's been a while since you've been on.
I try to get on when I can. I'm here to defend my honor, but I also enjoy a good 12 lead tracing, so I was compelled.
Right on. Well, maybe some week we'll. I was just trying to goad you onto coming. I was telling you that, you know, temperatures do matter, and you said they don't unless you're sticking it somewhere. So whatever.
Yes.
Good enough. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, man. I appreciate it. Mr. Steve Whitehead, my other so with the Colorado contingent's heavy tonight. Mr. Steve Whitehead, hello, sir.
I'm still flabbergasted because you used esteemed and then smart and then well done all in the same line. So I'm still catching my breath, but hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, right on. Well, thank you for coming on. And are you working tonight, or are you not going to have to run off on a call?
Am working tonight, so if I disappear, you'll know where I went.
Right on. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
So that's what you call it there, Steve, working?
Colloquially, we call it working, yeah. It's all relative, though.
Are you on a couch or are you in a recliner?
In a chair, just to make sure I don't nod off and start snoring while the podcast is going on.
Hey, we're not that boring. We're not that boring. I'm sorry. I'll have to defend my honor on that one. Oh, that's funny. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, Steve, and I hope you don't get any calls. Also joining us at 3 a.m. GMT is Mr. Mark Glencourse. Hello, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm trying to just to America time, getting ready for tomorrow.
Right. Oh, you're coming over here again?
Yeah.
For what? How do I not know this?
I'll leave. Well, this time tomorrow I'll leave. It's to film some more episodes of Seat at the Table next week. Have a tweet up and just say hello to my American friends again.
Right on. Well, very cool. Well, I'm glad you're coming back. You're going to San Francisco then, I take it?
Yeah, San Francisco, and then we're filming in a studio in San Jose on Tuesday.
Very cool. Maybe. Well, right on. Well, have fun and drink a pint for me. That'll be very good.
Oh, I shall.
Right
on.
More
than one.
Very good. More than one. I only need you to drink one because I'm a lightweight. Mr. Kyle David Bates, who knows that I'm a lightweight because we've drank in D.C. recently. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. Nice to see you on tonight. And you need to plug your new show. Do you want to talk about it?
Oh, sure. We can do that. We're going to be launching a new podcast called First Few Moments, Managing the Scene of a Motor Vehicle Crash. It's based on a full-day workshop that we do, classroom skill sessions and cars. And it's basically everything that happens from the time of call to the time that you get the patient out, everything from safety management, triage, and care. And we'll be launching that probably in the next couple weeks here.
Very cool. I'm excited to help you with that and be producing it. You've got some big heavy hitters coming on that show, so I definitely won't be able to compete with that. But I'll be on the first few episodes. That'll be fun.
I appreciate it.
I can't wait to hear it. Mr. Chris Kaiser, are you working as well?
Yes, I am working. So if you hear the tones in the background, that's probably me.
Right on.
I don't have a recliner to sit in, so I just have to sit in the ambulance and do the podcast from there.
How did you get the internet? I thought you didn't have internet now.
Well, I do now that I'm actually sitting in some neighborhood that I can't disclose, uh-huh. and I'm hoping that the homeowner doesn't see me outside the window in the ambulance my laptop. This is rural EMS at its best, baby. I tell you what.
That's awesome.
Are you staring through the window watching his TV as well?
Well, they have cable. I mean, we got to do something.
Oh, man. I feel so bad for you guys. Oh, my gosh.
Go cow tipping.
Yeah, they have no trash service, no cable, no internet, and they, yeah, poor people. And they, I think they sleep in a van down by the river, too.
You have to get the water. Get the water from the well.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I saw some ads cut out from the local Walmart. They're selling tents, and that's got me a little apprehensive.
Oh, it stresses.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it is summer. It's a good time. You'll be like an urban outdoorsman of EMS. That's awesome.
Sure got pretty lips.
It is Wisconsin. Tell you that.
Right on. Well, thank you guys for joining us. So tonight, our topics are we're going to talk about 12-lead EKGs, and we're going to talk about CPR, which is always fun. I love talking about CPR. But first, Mark, you're kind of the inspiration for this show, so I'd like you to delve a little bit deeper into what you posted this week. Maybe give people I'll post a link on the show notes of where people can find the post that you wrote. But tell us a little bit about what your inspiration was behind this this blog post.
Well, I'm a self-confessed ECG geek anyway. I've always been interested in it, and a few years ago, that magic thing happened where ECGs or EKGs just clicked, and they all of a sudden started to make sense, and I wanted to learn more and more about it. It got to the point where I now teach 12-lead ECG recognition, MI recognition, STEMI recognition for my service, but I wanted to know more than that as well. So went off and learned a whole load of other things, more advanced than probably what I need to know. And most of it has been from Tom Boothley's blog, Pre-Hospital 12-Lead ECG. And the last few weeks I've been committing myself to learn all about and learning a lot of what he's put on about ST elevation mimics and imposters and benign early repolarization, hypertrophies, and everything that looks like an MI when it actually isn't. And then I had a case a little while ago where I had this gentleman who didn't present with chest pain, had a little bit of a faint and hurt his knee, and that's why he called us. And went out to him, and because he'd had a faint, I did a 12-lead ECG anyway. And the Glow Life Pack 12 had a big message on the top of it saying, you know, extensive myocardial infarction, consider reperfusion. And I looked at his ECG, and there's a picture of that on the blog, and it does show clear ST elevation in the chest leads, but I wasn't convinced. You know, it had everything that I'd learned on recently about, well, whether it's either benign early repolarization or you know, strain patterns or whatever, but I just thought that's not actually an MI, and I was really confident with that. However, when it came down to deciding where to take him, whether to go to the local accident emergency ER or whether to take him to the angioplasty center, the PPCI center, even though I was convinced it wasn't an MI, I bottled out with the decision basically and still sent it off to the PPCI center, and they ran it past the consultant. The consultant agreed with what I was saying and didn't want him to go there and just took him to the normal casualty department, which got me to thinking about, you know, do we really need that level of knowledge? You know, there's always the arguments I work with, people I work with, is who they say, you know, this is all just nice to know, so you don't really need this for our job. And after that job, it got me thinking to whether they're actually right. You know, even though I have this extra knowledge now and I'm comfortable ruling, I'm very comfortable ruling in MIs, you know, the ones which aren't clear cut, but you're pretty sure that they are MI, I'm more than happy to take them off to the angioplasty centres. But it's a whole different thing to actually say, you know, even though this ECG, you know, formally looks like you're having an MI, I'm convinced you're not, therefore I'm not going to take you to the PPCI centre. And the question I posed on the blog was just, would anybody actually be willing to stick to the guns and do that without contacting medical control or whatever your local protocol is? Which comes back to the question, do we need to know that much? Or should we just stick to the basics, send them off to the hospitals and let them make the decisions for us?
So
I got an opinion about that.
I knew you would, Will. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I commend you for for getting into the 12-lead cardiology, because I think it's cool, and I do think paramedics need to know that to a certain extent. I looked at the tracing. I think it is. I would have sided with you. I think it's benign early repull. But what I've never seen before is a LIFEPAK 12 that makes treatment recommendations as well. I've seen them come up with diagnosis recommendations, but that's the first time I've ever seen one actually give a recommendation for therapy. All the services where I've ever worked, we turn that off on the LIFEPAK 12 because it's often wrong. And it's often distracting, but I think that this 12-lead would have gotten my attention, certainly. But I think that you do what's the right thing for your patient. I think this is a guy who does not have a good story for an MI, and he doesn't have reciprocal changes, which you would expect to see with an MI that presenting like the one in your tracing. So I think you could have very confidently said this is a casual finding. But on the other hand, if you don't, I think, run that past somebody, somebody somewhere is going to get a pretty big surprise, especially if it's a facility that doesn't always deal with MI cases. So my theory is that paramedics do need to know that. I think that it does make a difference in systems where the paramedics can activate a cath lab or a system or bypass a hospital to get to the patient to the right center in a timely manner. I don't think there's any reason for us to be transmitting those things unless you do have a controversial tracing like the one you showed. But ultimately, yeah, I think we need to know that. And I think that we can save a lot of time in getting pre-hospital tracings and doing the patient a real favor in being able to recognize that in the field.
Yeah, but that's all about ruling in an MI. Which is, I'm a complete advocate for teaching people more than just the basic, if there's 1 or 2 millimeters of ST elevation from the J point and things like that. You know, there's a lot of ECG tracings that come up which aren't classically showing that they're having a big MI, but there's enough there for you to maybe suggest it's starting, the ST elevation hasn't started yet. And that's the level of training which I think is invaluable for us, because that's the early activation, the early transports that we can do. But what I was trying to get at was, you know, the ruling out. You know, yes, it's essential that we rule people in and fast-track them to the right pathways when they're having an MI. But if you're trained to the level where you can pick up and diagnose a mimic, then is that something that we should be thinking of training paramedics to that level? Or is it always going to be that we're going to have to pass that final decision off to someone who earns a lot more, who can take the responsibility of the decision?
Did you give him aspirin or nitro, or did you treat him like he was having an MI?
No.
So I think that's your answer. I mean, I think that the guy's presentation doesn't support the evidence that you're seeing on the EKG. And I don't know if you're ever going to get somebody to buy off and say that paramedics can rule out an MI. I think that's actually kind of a different level of responsibility, I think, than ruling somebody in. But I think that's one of those age-old things where you're trying to treat your patient instead of your, that saying, treat your patient, not your monitor. I still think it's fascinating tracing, and I still think it's going to get somebody's attention, especially if you've got a computer-generated module that's declaring an MI. From what it sees, but that's a good question that you raise. I'm not sure you can necessarily want paramedics ruling somebody out, but I think that if there is a guy that you could rule out, it's the guy that was asymptomatic, that got a 12-lead for kind of a relatively benign reason, that looks good, that really doesn't have any complaints, and you didn't mention any potential risk factors that he has, but I'd say if you were trying to, what might be more interesting is if he tried to refuse, if he didn't want to go to the hospital. That would have actually been a more interesting. That would have added an extra twist to it. He says, I don't want to go.
Yeah, yeah. But I think then you'd have to go down the lines of, well, you could be, because then you've got to think of the whole responsibility side of it. And I can leave people at home. But the general rule is, if anyone's got anything, whether it's on an EKG or history, or anything remotely suggesting something cardiac, even if I think it wasn't, then they're going, it would be a hard refusal to accept.
Well, and Will already stole some of my thunder. What I was going to ask you is, I said, so in the UK, Mark, you treat the monitor and not the patient. So, I mean, I think that you have to have all of those things to rule it in. And beyond that, I think it's also important, too, to understand that we're paramedics I think you may have a better case for this than us here in the United States, but where you actually have clinicians practicing in the field that can make those decisions about treat no transport and do some things that are very outside the box of a traditional American EMS system or something like that. So I agree with Will though, it's very dangerous water to be saying I'm gonna completely not call it an MI.
Yeah,
your gut's right to go, you know, walk in and go, hey doc, this doesn't look like an MI, but you know, we might want to give him the benefit of the doubt. Here's all the reasons why, and really, you know, use it as a consult and a learning tool, both with you and the physician to say, you know, next time I call in and say it's not an MI, then he'll also trust you too to say, yeah, he's probably right. Or at least I'm not willing to ramp up the cath lab.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky in that I have a relationship with the coronary care I normally feed into, and now the PBCI centre, and that when I phone up, they know it's me, and they know I've done that little bit extra training and self-taught and stuff, and we can have that conversation very freely now. And when I spoke to the nurse in charge on the angioplasty unit, it was a case of, look, I've sent you this ECG, however, I really don't think it's an MI, but because of this, I thought you'd better just have a look over it, you know. And even she wasn't happy to make that decision herself. She went, right, I'm just going to speak to one of the consultants and I'll get straight back to you. So there was that passing the book all the way through.
Other thoughts or other people's opinion?
Actually, it's funny that you bring that up, Mark, because I, not too long ago, actually had that same situation with an elderly lady who was actually bradycardic, and she showed that in the inferior leads. It's the first time I kind of really recognized, you know, or saw the repolarization, and you know, I even faxed it off to my doc because we're going to bypass him, thinking about going down to the cath labs, and he was like, yeah, you know, let's not make this call. Let's send them down to the cath lab now. So it was an interesting learning experience to see that early repolarization. Our monitor actually caught it and actually said it as early repol.
Yeah, the problem is that monitor. I've seen the monitor declare early repol to somebody having a bitchin' MI. And so I think that you've got two different patients, you know, one that is at significant risk for a potential MI, especially if she's bradycardic. But, you know, that's kind of the, I mean, that's why EKGs are, I find them fascinating. And I think that's why we, you know, enjoy taking care of patients, to be able to sluice out what's pertinent, what's not. And I think that I'm right with you. I'd have a tough time saying that it's early repol on an elderly female, and a much easier time saying it's early repol on an adult, relatively young 32-year-old that's completely asymptomatic. But, you know, early repol is one of those things that tends to be caught as an aside. Workman comp physicals, insurance company physicals. The most of the time I've encountered somebody with early repol, it is a clinician that's generally reading an EKG not as part of a critical care workup, but as more of a you know, a yearly physical. Tends to be more in African American males and younger males at that, but it can be in just about anybody. So that's just one of the things that makes cardiology kind of interesting and fun.
But wouldn't it be great? The one thing I always do with virtually all of my patients anyway, I'll run a 12 lead off and then I'll run another copy off and actually give it to them. And so, you know, whatever happens at the hospital, if they say it's nothing, this is a normal ECG for you, that's the ones that aren't having an MI, but they've just got some abnormalities that I've found, you know, then try and keep this ECG with you, because if ever you need us again, it's like gold dust for us to be able to compare and say, well, that was your last one and that was great. And we're still on paper patient report forms. We don't have electronic PRFs. When our electronic ones do come in, we're hopefully going to be patched into the NHS spine, which gives us access to everyone's patient record and all the ECGs and stuff, and that would be great. But up until then, it's a bit flying in the dark at times, which was what makes it interesting, you know?
Now, Will, don't get me wrong. We didn't write her off as a early repol. I was actually more concerned if her being a possible MI, you know, on that, and we ran her down. It's actually the cardiologist that showed us that it was an early repull on her.
Sorry, if I gave the impression that, I didn't think that, and if I did, I certainly apologize. I just thought it was interesting that we got kind of bookended with two patients from two different ends of the spectrum. But I like Mark talking about giving a patient a 12-lead tracing. When I was working at Denver International Airport, I had a kid that was flying in on a flight from Canada that had a run of SVT, or what I figured was SVT. Palpitations that he reported on the flight. I was able to do a 12-lead at the airport and show that he did have WPW. And it's like, well, I don't believe there's anything we're going to do here for you, but here's the 12-lead, here's my card, take it home and figure out what to do with it. And I think that's brilliant that we have the way of getting a normal tracing or an EKG or something that we've done in someone's medical record. That's great.
Chris or Steve? Go ahead. Yeah, there you go. I knew you guys were coming on.
And Mark, it seems like you're asking two questions, and the one question is you know, can we rule out an MI in this guy in the field? And I, of the panel, I'm the one who I think I may have the highest index of suspicion on this guy. I mean, you're saying that he did have a syncopal episode prior to you being called. Looking at his 12-lead, V1 looks like early repull, but V2 and V3 has, I don't know, it looks to me like it has more of a downward arc than an upward arc. So, and even if it did, I don't know if we're ever going to get to the place where we're doing a complete rule out on a guy like this who's showing ST elevation. I don't know if that should be our role in pre-hospital care. But that brings us to the second question you're asking. So do we need to know this information anyway? And I say emphatically yes. You know, I mean, is it essential paramedic knowledge? No, maybe not. You know, picking up on MI pretenders and imitators, I think that's something that you can get later on in your experience. But is it great information? Should we, you know, be encouraging people to have it? Absolutely. Any information that we can get to help us with those, just that differential diagnosis on what do I think is going on here, for us to be able to say, you know, he's had a syncopal and I'm looking at his ST segment and I think there's a possibility this could be some sort of strange, 90% chance this guy's benign repull. For us to be able to say that, I think, is important and to have that knowledge, even though I don't think we're ever going to get to the place where we do a complete rule out on this guy and we rule out that.
Mm-hmm. And again,
I was going to say, I think that's well stated by Steve. And I think that what would have been the more fascinating question, I think, is the guy that didn't want to go and where do you go with that by saying, all right, here's what you got going in your favor. You don't look like a guy that's having a heart attack. You don't have complaints like a guy that's having a heart attack. You're relatively young. I don't think you got any risk factors. Here's what you got going against you. You had this pesky syncopal episode, and I can't tell you why that happened. I noticed actually that was one of the things on the 12-lead that did catch my eyes. It looked like the QT length was a little prolonged, not quite prolonged to the point where I think I would be excited about it. But I thought that was an interesting finding on the 12-lead, which is kind of a cool thing that you saw. But it's kind of like in one of those cases where you've got somebody who may not be able to afford the care, may not have insurance to cover it, may have all these other factors that unfortunately influence his decision. And I think that's where, as paramedics, we have the ability to really affect something that's happening and saying, look, here's the things that you got going in your favor. Here's the things that you got going against you. And I think this is a guy, I'm right with you, Mark. I would not have been comfortable at all leaving him if he tried to refuse.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, that's if he refused, then my only option there would be, you know, get him to sign the refusal forms anyway, but then he would be passed straight on to his own GP, and the GP would get all the details, and the GP would have to come out, or the family doctor would have to come out and see him. Because, again, it's too risky for him to just accept his refusal, if that had been what happened.
So what happens if he wants to refuse and you're not comfortable with that? A physician comes to the scene?
The GP, we would refer on to the GP, who's like a local community doctor. And one of two things would happen, depending on the ability of the patient. Either they would be seen very quickly in the surgery, where the patient would go travel to the surgery, or I guess in that case, a GP would have to come out. Because then it's the GP's decision whether he goes or not.
That would be awesome.
It's amazing how many times paramedics will say, we think you need to go, and they say no. And then usually it's just a case of getting the GP on the phone. I mean, we have a system where we can phone out of hours doctors or surgery doctors, and we have a medical advice service where they guarantee that they'll phone back. In one of our areas, they'll guarantee to phone back within 5 minutes. In another area, it's up to 20 minutes. But it's usually when the GP comes on the phone and says to the patient, you need to go, then they believe the GP and then they travel anyway.
Really? Said it was a good idea. Yeah. Hey, while we're all being ECG geeks, does this guy look hypertrophic to anybody else for a 32-year-old male?
A little. You know what's cool about this podcast, though? Is we can be looking at an EKG strip that we would have had to look at in a CE setting, you know, in some lecture 6 months from now, if Mark had been on the circuit, we would have never seen this. This is great. I mean, this is cool. I'm sorry. I just think it's really cool that we could be talking about a patient that, and we can zoom in on it and it looks very, very pretty. Chris, you don't have any comments about this?
Well, I must confess, I'm sitting here fascinated by your guys' knowledge of ECGs, and I looked at it and I said, well, there's ST elevation, but the patient doesn't look like he's presenting as an MI. So yeah, I looked at the ECG and I said, wow, that's interesting. And my first thing would be to fax it up to my doctor and say, hey, I don't think this guy's having an MI because he just doesn't present like he's having one. My clinical findings aren't saying that he is. And I would probably, in my setting, not bypass my local ER and tie up the one cardiac cath lab that we have an hour away, just because of his clinical presentation and because the ECG just doesn't, you know, and I'm no expert on these by any stretch of the imagination, it just doesn't look heart attack-y to me. I do see, I see what you guys were saying, but like I say, I'm no expert. You know, you're a little bit over my head with my knowledge on the ECG stuff, even though I've been reading Tom's stuff as much as I can. But based on his clinical presentation, I wouldn't think he was having a STEMI probably, or an MI, but I wouldn't feel comfortable ruling it out based with my knowledge of what he was having and what I saw.
But I'm at that exact same point in the post, and that if you get to a level of knowledge where without even picking out the nitty-gritties, you just look at it and it's a case of that doesn't really look like an MI. It's exactly what you just said there, you know.
But, you know, you think of, I don't know, I have no idea what the percentages are, but let's say you've got a medic somewhere that's not trained in 12-lead cardiology, that just has leads 1, 2, and 3, and maybe will run MCL1 or MCL6. That's not going to show up at all. There's going to be really nothing, maybe a little bit of takeoff, which still reminds me of early repol and lead two. But, you know, the only thing that I think that a lead two medic would find on this is perhaps a little bit of a long QT interval, and that's about it. So that's actually what I find even more fascinating here is that this is one of those cool tracings that you're not going to find that kind of interesting information that provokes the worry of an MI unless you are doing a true 12-liter, you're running MCL2 or MCL3.
There's an interesting theory here. And in my area, I respond as a paramedic to back up EMT Basic and EMT IV Tech squads. Our service allows the Basics and the IV Techs, which are a level above Basic, to run 12-lead EKGs but not interpret them. They go based solely on the monitor's interpretation of them. I can imagine this ECG and the LifePak's interpretation giving me a heck of an ALS intercept. The basic squad would run that and say, extensive MI? Oh my goodness, I have to get my ALS up here, and I'd probably meet them halfway to the cath lab as they were running hot into it. I can imagine that would be a very likely scenario for me, and at that point I just go with it because, well, everybody else is, and And I wouldn't want to degrade the monitor's interpretation of that when I had other clinicians telling me, hey, we think it's an MI2. It'd be a far-fetched scenario, but I could see that happening in the system I work in.
That's not the patient that the monitor's going to hurt, or this guy. I mean, if you do that with this dude, probably no harm, no foul, as long as everybody's careful about how to administer the medications and you do your cardiac workup. The person who gets hurt by that is that person that Will's talking about, who's having the massive MI and gets the monitor interpretation that says benign early repolarization. And then hopefully you've at least got clinicians that have the clinical skills to say, all right, the monitor's saying one thing, but the crushing radiating chest pain and the pale diaphoretic skin and everything else tells me something else. I'm going to go with my gut. Hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was interesting because after you talked about the hypertrophy, I started looking at those P waves and V1, 2, and 3, and sure enough, they have the classic sign of the double peak, and I don't know. Did he have any other previous history of, you know, enlarged heart or anything from his childhood? Or I mean, did he know anything? No, wow.
No. I mean, the only other thing which I didn't actually mention in the blog was, I mean, he wasn't a very, very thin man, but he didn't have a lot of, you know, fatty or muscly tissue on his chest. So an element of the voltage criteria and stuff will be something to do with the fact that there wasn't much impedance through his chest wall. But other than that, you know, it was just fine.
Interesting. So that physical exam also is not typical of somebody with early repol. They tend to actually be kind of rail thin. But what was the event? What led up to his loss of consciousness?
He didn't really know. All he said was he was walking down his hallway. He felt a little bit dizzy and collapsed to the floor. And when I said, you know, did he lose consciousness stuff, he couldn't really remember. Therefore, I take that as a yes. And it was actually the fall where he hurt his knee, which is when he said that's what he called the ambulance for, was the pain in his knee, not anything to do with the collapse or anything like that.
Did you happen by chance to throw a stethoscope over his heart and listen to his heart valves open and close?
Did, I wouldn't know what I was listening to. That's not something we're trained in. I'm learning that just off my own back, but I wouldn't feel confident in listening to abnormal heart sounds. We're not taught that at all.
Because I think that's actually a really good habit to get into. If you're going to have your stethoscope anyway out listening to either lung sounds or a blood pressure, to just throw it over the heart and listen to the lub-dub of the heart. Because this guy actually... So now it's got. Now this is an interesting picture. You got a 32-year-old that's got this kind of syncopal for unknown cause with a little bit of hypertrophy, and I'm wondering if he's got a murmur. I wonder if he's got like a critical aortic stenosis or something. This tells you what my practice is like. The most interesting patient I've seen in weeks is your patient.
From the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, and I guess maybe we need to go back to the point that Mark asked then. Do we as paramedics need to understand or have a understanding of this? And not necessarily because we're going to rule something out, but because we need to know what normal looks like. And then when something doesn't look normal, we need to investigate it further, i.e., we know what a normal, quote-unquote, MI looks like, or a normal tracing for an MI on an EKG looks like. So you see this, along with the symptoms, like, and then you start heading down that road of, gee, I need to investigate this a little bit more. Again, not ruling it out, but I think you kind of made your own argument, Mark, is I think we do need to know this. And it just goes back to a bunch of things I've been saying recently is, you know, we can't all be cardiologists and we can't all be gastroenterologists and we can't all be those things. But if we know our practice well enough to know the things that are most important, that's what's going to make the most difference in a patient's life.
Mm-hmm.
So
definitely
if our hand is forced, then do we need to know the information in the first place? Worth considering that, especially on a dude like this, everybody's hand is forced. You know, our hand is forced. The nurse on the radio, her hand was forced. The cardiologist's hand is forced. He is going to do all the appropriate rollouts. He's going to draw bloods. He's going to check troponins. He's going to do every. He's going to, you know, schedule this guy for a treadmill. Even though everybody in the picture knows that is most likely he is an early repolarization candidate, but just because our hand is forced as clinicians doesn't mean that we shouldn't be in on the clinical knowledge that lets us know what's probably going on.
So, Mark, what's the punchline? Did you follow up on this guy?
Yeah, I followed up on him the next day, and it was there was nothing cardiac. He was seen in the local accident and emergency, and he was just threatened discharged with a follow-up, but nothing acute.
Did he have any other history of syncopal episodes, or was that his only one?
Only one.
Wow. Call him.
So.
No, never mind.
Other final.
We should get him on the podcast.
That'd be funny.
Did you enjoy your treatment? Do you have anything you want to feed back to the paramedics? Oh, the clock on our ECG on that vehicle is always wrong. Sometimes, for some reason, they took the clocks out of the back of the ambulances, so it was a case of we used to rely on the monitor. And the monitors just are so out now, we just use our mobile phones. That was actually. So we never go by the clocks on the monitors.
Apparently we know that in the UK there's not a lot of tort because, yeah, that would cause a lot of angst in our, even in our system. Everything's synced to exactly this. That's crazy. Well,
do you guys ever look at your watch?
We're not allowed to wear watches.
Really?
No, wait. You're not allowed?
Yeah. No, infection control, bare below the elbow. No watches to be worn. We've just started to get these sort of clip-on, sort of carabiner-style watches, which some of us are wearing, but no watches.
Yeah, so instead of a watch that you have on your wrist, you pull out your phone to look at your phone for the time that you're going to put next to your face. Yeah, that's awesome.
Exactly.
Right on.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that every time I do it.
Brilliant, I say. Wow. Well, perfect case, Mark. Thank you very much. Well, the next topic I want to talk about, probably not as scintillating, but a study examines the effect of delayed defibrillation in CPR. And apparently it wasn't clinically significant, nor statistically significant, the Australians found. But did anybody have a chance to read through the post on EMS Responder and give any feedback?
Well, to me, it just went, do what you want. It doesn't seem to make a difference whether you do a bit of compression first or not.
But doesn't that fly in the face of reason of everything we've been told recently? I mean, that, you know, reperfusion, get the heart going a little bit, and then hit it with something? Doesn't that make more sense, really?
Is that what you used to do with that analogy?
My all-time favorite story to back that up was a woman that had a cardiac arrest on a medical campus, and it took them, I don't know, something like 15 or 17 minutes to actually get a defibrillator to where she was, because her office was in the basement, way back part of the hospital or a medical office building. And they defibrillated her once, and she woke up, and she wound up being completely neurologically intact with 15, 17 minutes of chest compressions. And it turns out the place where she had her cardiac arrest was the CPR instructor's office.
Oh.
And so I think that we probably are not as good at CPR as we should be. I heard a rumor that in Seattle you've got a qualify every quarter with good chest compressions, and nothing that we've done in 20 or 30 years seems to have made a difference in getting survival rates, you know, on average over about 4%. I'm willing to try anything, and if some compressions first make clinical and reasonable logical sense, why not?
True, but hey, my service is at 100% for the year. We've only had
one call.
Yeah, well, the one CPR case. But yeah, you know, at least he walked out of the hospital and he's completely okay. So amazing.
I would just like to know how many people they actually enrolled, because I'm looking at the the abstract in resuscitation, and there's no numbers.
That's what I found weird. I was wondering what they compared to. I mean, because when you look at some of the cardiac arrest registries that they've got in Europe and some of the other places that are enrolling thousands of patients, my guess is, and without having read anything other than the abstract, that their numbers... I think that if you've got a study where you've got an N number, which is attention-grabbing or headline-worthy N numbers, you put that into your abstract, and I think that when you don't, you tend not to. But I don't know. I haven't seen anything else with this study.
Well, 658 patients.
Where did you see that, Chris?
Right near the bottom. Right near the bottom.
But, okay, well, that's a decent end. You got me there. I retract my last statement.
Well, no, but then they say it's not statistically significant in the findings. It sounds like it might. Well, maybe that the difference is only 0.94, so maybe that's why they're talking about it. But I don't know. I mean, I couldn't find the article or the actual, or I didn't read the abstract, so that's probably why. It would help if I did.
It's interesting to me that they did a controlled randomized trial on whether you got CPR or not. That's... there's no way in hell you'd be able to do that in the U.S.
Yeah, again, you have to go to places where they won't sue you to do that, which would be nice. Kyle, did you have more thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just seems like there's more. You like to put this stuff out there and say, hey, cool, check it out. It doesn't make any difference. But, you know, if it doesn't make any statistical difference, why are we talking about it? Not us, but like in terms of the procedures.
Well, yeah, and then in the conclusion, EMS jurisdictions are justified continuing the current practice using either defibrillation strategy. So you can do it either way, so they don't really care. So everything we've been training on and changing, and the AHA is about ready to release the next version of what we're going to be changing everything up against. I don't know. Does it really matter?
Well, I mean, it matters if you're the dude having the cardiac arrest.
Okay, good point. Someday it might be me.
I mean, I'm willing to try. I'm willing to give anything a try. I mean, we are, the number of patients that I've, encountered that have survived a cardiac arrest is so few, and none of my patients survive. So that might be me, but, I mean, I'm willing to give anything a try.
Sorry I've been so quiet, but my radio is squawking here since I'm at work here. But I have a theory, and it may have came out before, and in fact, I'm sure it has. But is there a statistically significant benefit to people that do studies on their survival rates in CPR? Because I think that they'd do better CPR if they knew they were part of a trial and they knew they were getting studied with it.
Oh yeah,
the Hawthorne effect is a powerful, powerful thing.
That's
so, you're talking Hawthorne effect, and I completely agree with you. But when they've done things like videotape different cardiac arrests in the hospital and just tell them all, and not necessarily be forthcoming with what they're trying to find, that's some of those studies where they find that in hospital cardiac arrest they're doing like compressions 40% of the time, or out of hospital cardiac arrest we're doing compressions like 60% of the time or something. So yeah, you kind of have to get a little sneaky, because the Hawthorne effect will get you every time.
But that's why sometimes it's even hard to do research in EMS, because at least in the United States, because people know that you are... it's very hard to do a blind study as well, double blinded and all those issues that really make it a good study. It's very hard to do.
But I mean, it depends on what you're trying to do, but that's why the polyheme study that was, 5 years ago in the U.S. was so groundbreaking, because they were doing a controlled randomized double blinded once they opened the envelope, but a controlled randomized trial without subjects' consent. But I mean, unfortunately, that's going to be the gold standard for scientific studies, a double-blinded controlled randomized trial. But I think you can still get pretty good information with good, decent numbers with retrospective data, especially that's where you can at least circumvent the Hawthorne effect is go back and look at a bunch of historical data on things, on how things were done. Since there was no potential for Hawthorne effect at that point. And that'll get you somewhere. I mean, that's probably better than nothing.
All good
everything
point.
That you collect ahead, data. Yeah, for everything that you collect data on. If you didn't collect data, like that whole, you know, videotaping CPR to see what percentage of time you're actually doing compressions, you can't retrospectively look at that, obviously. But Will brought up a great thing with the polyheme thing. It's a whole second layer of complication with pre-hospital research is consent. Consent is huge, and it's incredibly important to be able to have people consent before they participate in research. But that was a very interesting trial that they were able to decide that they were going to do two significantly different types of treatment in a randomized trial in the pre-hospital setting without getting individual consent from the patients.
Because the way they did it was pretty cool because they did it... are you talking about the polyheme? Yeah, because cool because they did a blanket notification and say, if you don't want to be involved, here's how you do it. And I thought that was pretty cool.
It was fascinating. It says we are going to consider your consent in the study if you don't opt out. But I mean, that was, there aren't very many of those, at least with which I'm aware, at least especially with pre-hospital. It might be the only one. It's the only one that I'm aware from a pre-hospital standpoint where we just say, oh, we're going to assume that your consent, we're going to assume your consent unless you call this number. That polyheme was a fascinating study. That's a whole other podcast right there.
Yeah, maybe we could get some people on from Denver Health, and maybe Chris will come on, Chris Caldwell, and talk about some of the issues. Was it Chris who was driving that study, or was it Pond?
It was actually Dr. Gene Moore was first okay. author on that study, was my understanding. But Dr. Caldwell was very involved, but. Denver, from what I understand, enrolled more patients in the first 3 months of that study than almost everybody else combined. And there started to be questions about why other people weren't being enrolled. And I'm not sure if those answers really were forthcoming, but ultimately the conclusions were that the polyheme was no better than saline. And I'm not sure that those conclusions were disappointing for the researchers and for obvious reasons, but I'm not. And there was some theories on why they got those conclusions, but oh well. I mean, we'll find something eventually. It's better than salt water
and blood. Those two things. That'd be nice.
Because of that because of that consent issue. The plug got pulled very fast on that study. As soon as the data started to look iffy for the polyheme candidates, because of that, you know, you have to rule yourself out type of consent. I think maybe it caused them to pull the plug pretty fast. But it would have been nice to see that study go on for a little bit more time and them to try to tweak it, play with it a little bit.
Right, Steve, I forgot that you actually wrote a whole article on that for GEMS. did you continue to follow polyheme after you wrote that article?
I didn't. And all of the research, everything I was allowed to do was before the study got underway, and they were very forthcoming and easy to, you know, share information with me up until the very first patient got enrolled. And then I kind of learned a lesson of medical journalism when I called the paramedic who had administered the polyheme and talked to him a little bit about what it was like, and that caused a huge stir. Apparently, you know, when research is in progress – and they're planning on, you know, publishing it in the New England Journal of Medicine, having other magazines and journalists publish actual results of what's happening and what's going on is real touchy. So there was a big lockdown, and there was emails sent out saying, you know, nobody talks to the media. And I understand why they have to do that. But after I was kind of shut out of it, I wrote the article, and then I didn't follow up much on it.
Yeah, I guess I'd kind of forgotten that you had written that for Gems, but you know, I understand that they had a patient that was given polyheme in the field. That on the when they did a check the patient's hematocrit on the pre-hospital blood draw before he got the polyheme, the guy had a crit of 0. And survived, and actually survived a discharge and did well. And that's, I don't know how else you live through having a crit of 0 unless there was something else that was carrying oxygen. So that's when I heard that story, which was not necessarily public information, but it wasn't, I was working at Denver Health when that study was happening, and you know, that story was discussed. That seemed to me that it was a very promising thing. So it's kind of, I was surprised actually when they pulled the plug when they did.
So was I, and I was disappointed, especially to see that not only did the study go away, but we haven't pursued oxygen therapeutics much in the pre-hospital setting at all since that happened. And even at the time of the study, there were better products out there. Sorry, Polyheme, for saying that, but there's another one. I think it was called Hemapure that was didn't require the refrigeration, had a longer expiration. There's some really cool oxygen therapeutics out there, and it seems like it put the damper on all of the oxygen therapeutic research, which is really unfortunate. Yeah, I was disappointed as well.
And there was another product, actually, that was before Polyheme that I think was a product. I guess probably, but there was another blood substitute that was studied beforehand where a lot of patients were getting the blood substitute that probably didn't need it, and they had significant intracranial issues from that, and that also put a damper on it. And so I guess the spin that came into it is you can't trust paramedics to be able to participate in research.
And that's a shame. I mean, really, maybe someday when we get an American College of Paramedicine, we'll be able to do more research, get people really doing it and understanding us for the profession we are.
And here's another study using trying to catch a field temperature on a patient using something other than an invasive method. I find it interesting that pre-hospital providers and other hospital providers think that you can get a ballpark of a patient's temperature from an oral thermometer. But I heard a great line actually yesterday from a physician in Denver that called an oral thermometer a random number generator.
However, I will say one thing. It's just like taking a pulse. It could be any number at any time. Doesn't mean it's necessarily accurate or correct, but it's a snapshot of the patient at that point.
Unless you're talking about a tympanic temperature reading, and then it's a random number.
I'm not going to argue because I have no argument. I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't care either way. You just want me to argue, and I can't because I don't care. You know, I think that we ought to be doing rectal temps on everybody, and that's why you have an EMT in the back of the ambulance. Oh, sorry, EMTs. Just teasing.
So is it not enough just to say it feels hot to touch anymore?
I'm all for that, but I think that when you start trying to get a number that you know is wrong, I mean, that's where I have a problem. I think that if you know a number is wrong, then you shouldn't be gathering it.
Hot.
See, this patient felt hot. It felt warm to touch. Oh, they were shivering. They felt cool to the touch. I think that's actually far more of a reasonable assessment than the random number generator.
Unless your hands are perpetually cold or perpetually hot, then you would have a problem really determining that as an EMS provider. My hands are always cold.
You should kiss their forehead then.
Yeah, no. Not going to do it. Not going to happen. All right. Well, I think Steve Whitehead had a call, and that's probably a good point to stop the podcast anyway. And we'll there will be edits, so sorry, people. You'll miss part of the podcast, but that's okay. So, Mr. Will Dunn, where can people find you if you want to be found?
You know, I'm still trying to Twitter, but I don't do a very good job with that. I think I'm done WW at Twitter. Certainly, if anybody wants to email me, I'm happy. And I got actually a bunch of emails when we did the pain management podcast a month or two ago. Dunnww, it's DUNNWW at yahoo.com. I just got accepted a couple of presentations for the Texas EMS conference in November, so it looks like I'll be going to Austin in November to present. And I'm going to be out in Washington, D.C. in 2 weeks at a conference working on some BLAST guidelines that I was working with Dr. Peter Pons on. So that's what I'm doing currently.
Cool. Hey, if you're a Texas listener and you have anything to do with the Texas EMS conference, I want to go too. So let me know, because I want to be invited. We want to come down and do some podcasting. I hear that that's a great show, so have a lot of fun. I hear it's as big as many of the national shows, so that's pretty cool.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm excited. Yeah, I was very excited to be in, to have some presentation accepted, and I'm looking forward to going.
Right on. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, and I'll always rile you up a little bit. I got to figure out a way to get you on and rile you up, because I love having you on. Thanks, Will. Mr. Mark Glencourse, where can people find you, besides everywhere?
I'm very shy. I don't like to get out there too much. My blog, obviously, 999medic.com. I'm on Twitter, UKMedic999. Facebook, just search for Medic999. And if you're in San Francisco or anywhere near California, I'll be there from Saturday afternoon. We've got a tweet up on Wednesday night. That's going to be at the Pyramid Ale House in Walnut Creek. And then we've got the filming of the 3 episodes of Seat at the Table on Tuesday, where there's going to be a live chat room as well. There'll be details of that on the Chronicles of EMS website. And I'll be spending the next, well, from tomorrow. I'm coming over some very strange way. I'm going from Newcastle to Brussels, then Brussels to Chicago, then Chicago to San Francisco.
That sounds miserable.
The journey from hell. But hey, it's worth it to get over there again. So I can't wait to meet everyone. I think Miss Paramedic and Jeremiah is coming up to see us and have a drink and stuff, so it's a shame you couldn't be coming yourself.
Oh, well, that's okay. You know, I didn't even know about it till you just said it. So, well, you never know. Hey, well, real quick question for you. Actually, two things. One, what is this contest I heard about?
Oh, the contest, again, this, you can find this at the Chronicles VMS website if you look under Name the Show Competition. Ted's been working furiously to try and get us a big TV deal so we can make the series everything that we wanted to be. And one bit of feedback that I got from the executives was that they didn't particularly like the name Chronicles VMS, the reality series. They didn't like the reality series side of it. So we've got a competition where we're wanting our supporters, viewers, listeners, whatever, to log on, join the community, and then post some suggestions for a new name for the show. The winner gets an iPad, and they also get round trip flights and 3 nights accommodation of their choice wherever they want to come in the world where we'll be filming. So once we have our filming schedule, they choose where they want to come, and we'll fly them out, and they can be part of the Chronicles teams for a few days and see what we actually get up to.
Very cool. And is the family coming with you this time, at least?
No.
Oh, man. You're doing a lot of traveling without them. That's got to be tough.
It is. But
hopefully there won't be a volcano.
No. Well, we just fly through. We fly through it these days because it's too expensive not to fly the planes, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so we'll just risk everybody's life. It's fine. It's all good.
Yeah.
Well, I felt bad when you came to Denver that we had you stranded here for days on end. That was funny.
British Airways looked after me well, and the amount of offers I had from people to go and stay with them and that were going to come and entertain me. Steve offered for me to go out on a ride along with him while I was there, but it was just a case of I didn't want to be too far away from the airport in case they suddenly said we could fly out. But I was very well looked after.
Right on. Well, very good. Well, thanks for coming on tonight and or this morning for you, and sharing all of your EKG fun on that patient with us. That was really great. Mr. Kyle David Bates, where can people find you, sir?
The website, kyledavidbates.com. Twitter at ImageMedic. FirstFewMoments.com will be up shortly. It's just a place holding it right now. We'll be going to the NEMSI conference in Illinois in September, Expo at the end of September, and just found out I'll be going up to Anchorage, Alaska in November for a conference.
Cool. Hey, I heard Chris Cerebello, I can never say his name, I can't say his name. He's going to kill me when he hears this. He was wondering if you're coming to NEMSI because he wants to meet up with you guys.
Yep, I am. We are.
You doing an EduCast there too?
I haven't heard anything about that yet. I'm doing a pre-conference workshop, and basically where I tell everyone how their slides are terrible and we need to fix them.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I've already had that. I don't need that pre-conference workshop. Thanks a lot.
That was fun. It wasn't that bad.
It was great.
Was it?
You know what? And it's actually been called one of the best presentations people have seen in a long time. So thanks a lot.
No problem. It's kind of funny. Greg and I kind of came up with the idea last year when we were sitting through some of the sessions, going, "Oh my God, I can't read more than 40 words on a slide." So decided to come up with this workshop, and I'm doing just a regular session called Cheated, which is the method that I use for creating case-based lectures.
Nice, right on. Well, thank you, Mr. Chris Kaiser. Where can people find you?
Well, I'm always available at lifeunderthelights.com. I'm on Twitter at CKEMTP. And I don't have my own special Facebook thing. I'm just Chris Kaiser. But Mark promised me something tonight that didn't happen. And I'm not going to foreshadow, just other than say I was a little disappointed. But that's okay.
She couldn't. She'll be on sometime soon.
Okay.
I know.
I'm placated.
More on that in another podcast, hopefully another week or two. Because I want to get her on here. That'll be awesome.
It's going to be a riot.
It'll be great.
It's going to be a riot.
Oh, she had strict rules.
Then she's not allowed on my show. Oh, that's awesome. Well, I can't wait for her to come on. And we saved the last for the best, Mr. Steve. Well, okay, maybe the best for last? No, I don't know. We saved something for you, Steve. So you left, and now you're back, and we're glad you're back. So tell us about the EMT spot. Is that where people can find you?
Yeah, you can always find me at my blog at www.theemtspot.com. And you can find me on Twitter, Steve Whitehead. And you can find me at EMS Expo. Come by, say hi, shake my hand. I'd love to meet you.
You're coming to Expo, too. Man, it's going to be a fun party this year. It's going to be really good. You know, I've heard a rumor, just so everybody knows, that we're probably going to have some free drink tickets and one night of a really large meetup. So come and meet us all. We'll all be hanging out drinking for free. And we'll get you guys some tickets, too. Just find us at EMS Expo. If you haven't made plans to go, you really do now. It sells out fast, and the spaces fill up quickly. So get your spot. It's in Dallas, Texas this year. Probably, you know, it's not Vegas, but that's okay, because now we'll know. We'll see you at each of the educational offerings the next morning or next afternoon, whatever your case may be. But we really are excited to be in Dallas, Texas this year coming up. Couple things from me. One, you can hear a few new podcasts coming up on EMS Radio. Go to emsradio.com and you'll hear a new podcast from Kyle David Bates. He's already talked about that. You're also going to hear a brand new podcast from Jamie Davis and I. It's a video podcast, so you'll have to look at our ugly mugs. It's called This Week in EMS, TWIEMS. And the website will be up very soon, and the new shows will be popping up probably about the same time Kyle's does. We're working through a few logistical issues, and we hope to have guests on as regular as we do on the EMS Garage. And it will be topics about EMS in the news every week. So we're going to pull some EMS articles and talk about news. And if your service has made the news and you want to talk about it, or you want us just to rail on your service in general, call us, because it's going to be, or just email us and send us the link to the story, because it'll be a lot of fun for us. And finally, thanks for joining us, and thanks for listening. We've been receiving a ton of listener comments, so I know our show is growing, and I thank you guys for writing in and telling us what you think. So always do that. You know how to interact with us. EMSGarage@gmail.com, on Twitter, EMSGarage, or you can just call us because we like calls. If you, in case you missed it, go back to last week's show and listen to the very, very end. I always stick things at the very end of the show, even after the credits roll. There was a listener that called in. We included his comment at the end of the show last week. So if you missed that, go back and listen. I'm Chris Montero. Thanks for joining, and we'll tune in next week when you can hear more about issues that concern you and EMS. Good night.